Hello, John Dennis here on Wednesday, the 4th of March. Today, after a gang of heavily armed terrorists launch a commando-style attack on the Sri Lankan cricket team in Lahore, we ask whether Pakistan is sliding into chaos.
There was shattered glass where the attack took place, and on closer inspection of the shopping centres, there were many bullet marks from apparently very powerful weapons.
Also today, after meeting Barack Obama in the White House, Gordon Brown tells both houses of Congress why America should support his plans for reforming the global markets and cleaning up the banks. And we hear from Orlando Figes, who tells us why a Russian publisher has shelved plans to print his book The Whisperers, about life under Stalin, in Russia.
Publishers are frightened of coming out with a book whose history, you know, is inconvenient to the regime.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, let's have the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In Pakistan, security forces are still searching for at least a dozen armed gunmen who attacked the Sri Lankan cricket team. The teams arrived home in an emotional reunion with their families. Police have discovered a large cache of arms and supplies from the area where the attack took place. Opposition MPs say authorities had been warned in advance of the attack. We'll have more from Pakistan after this news. In Sri Lanka, there's been a warning of a humanitarian disaster. The International Red Cross says up to 150,000 may be trapped in the northeast as the government lays siege to the Tamil Tiger rebels. The ICRC has called for an evacuation of civilians and for more aid to be flown in. Gordon Brown will make his first speech to the American Congress today, only the fifth British Prime Minister to be honoured in this way. He'll argue against a protectionist response to the economic crisis. He'll urge the US to seize the moment and lead the world out of recession. We'll hear from Washington later in Guardian Daily. Mr Brown will also announce the veteran US Senator Ted Kennedy will be awarded an honorary knighthood. The Queen will grant the honour to the 77-year-old brother of former President John Kennedy for services to peace in Northern Ireland and for relations between Britain and the USA. Here in Britain, ITV is expected to say it'll have to cut as many as 500 jobs today, according to unions. The broadcaster is announcing its financial results. It's expected to have to make sales of assets, such as the website Friends Reunited, or to close studio facilities. Not much joy in the morning papers either. We're at war, says the front page of The Independent, telling us that Pakistan is in shock after the attack on the cricketers. Sport in line of fire as terrorists switch tactics, says the Times. The Mirror has a gory picture of dead bodies, but a headline calling ex-England cricketer Chris Broad a bloody hero. It reports he threw himself on top of a wounded umpire during a hail of bullets in the attack. The Guardian reports a warning of attack on Sri Lankan team was ignored because of the Pakistan political crisis. The paper leads with Gordon Brown in America, saying the speech of his life, but Brown will not say sorry. The Telegraph shares the same front page lead. It argues that Brown was growing increasingly isolated from his cabinet colleagues over his refusal to apologise for the recession. It points out that both Alistair Darling and Ed Balls have accepted some responsibility. The Financial Times and The Express take an optimistic view of the PM's US visit. Obama says we do love Britain, says The Express. Brown wins support for a shake-up of global regulation, is the FT's version. But the pink paper leads with grim news from the oil industry. It says the falling oil price means BP has to freeze its dividend payment to shareholders and that it will also have to try to cut costs. More breaking news through the day at guardian.co.uk.
Yesterday's attacks on the Sri Lankan cricket team in Lahore sent shockwaves across the world and weakened further the already shaky authority of Pakistan's government. After months of political turmoil in Pakistan and a series of security crises, there's now almost no chance of it hosting any international sporting events for the foreseeable future. Foreign Affairs columnist Simon Tisdall says yesterday's attacks provide more evidence that Pakistan is becoming a failed state.
Well, I'm afraid many Pakistanis and outside observers may come to that conclusion, John. You know, the attack took place despite a very heavy security screen that was thrown up around the Sri Lankan team, and obviously the previous warnings to other cricketing teams like India and England, worries that they might be attacked. And the attack has still managed to get through to some extent, although the brunt of the attack was taken by some very brave policemen. Some people will see that as symptomatic of a wider malaise, a failure of the Pakistani government to be able to control the security environment, not only in terms of jihadi terrorists, but in terms of the Taliban infiltrating into Afghanistan and in terms of agitation in Kashmir.
Where does it leave Pakistan's ability to host Test cricket?
Well, listening to the spokesman for the International Cricket Council, one would think that the future of Test cricket in Pakistan is on hold, and that from now on, for the foreseeable future, any international cricket that Pakistan plays will be played abroad.
And it's against the backdrop of some very vicious infighting at, among the political classes of Pakistan.
Well, yes, as we were saying, this can't be seen as an isolated incident. It follows closely on the Mumbai attacks, which were blamed on Pakistani-based militants. And it also follows a year of increasing political turmoil in Pakistan. It's only 6 months or so since the army strongman General Pervez Musharraf, who ran the country after a military coup for nearly 10 years from 1999, was finally forced out of office. And yet the two leading political parties, the Nawaz Sharif's Muslim League and the Pakistan People's Party, led by Ali Asif Zardari, Benazir Bhutto's widower, are at each other's throats. And there's a big row going on about who runs Punjab, which is the most populous and most powerful of the provinces. And Nawaz Sharif is now planning to lead an enormous protest march on Islamabad, presumably with a perhaps tacit view to overthrowing the government.
The attack bore a grim similarity to the terror attacks on Mumbai in November, as The Guardian's Haroon Sadiq reports from Lahore.
There was shattered glass where the attack took place, and on closer inspection of the shopping centres, there were many bullet marks from apparently very powerful weapons. There was a rocket launcher that was fired by gunmen at the Sri Lankan team bus, which fortunately missed but hit a shopping centre. This attack was captured on television cameras because CNBC, the news organisation, actually had an office on the corner of this roundabout, and when they heard shots being fired, they actually filmed. It's a very busy area of Lahore, and Lahore is a very, very busy, congested, polluted city. Fortunately, this attack took place a couple of hours before the shops were due to open, otherwise the death toll could have been much worse. Rather extraordinarily, having experience of UK crime scenes, they haven't sealed off the area apart from to traffic, and pedestrians are milling about, and I saw a young child retrieve a bullet out of a pond at the centre of the roundabout. And I myself found a bullet casing as well.
Well, as we've heard, the future of international cricket in Pakistan is in doubt after yesterday's attack. New Zealand plans to tour there in November, and Pakistan, along with Sri Lanka and India, are to host the World Cup in 2011. Simon Willis is the coach of Kent County Cricket Club. He told us how one of his friends, Paul Farbrace, assistant coach of the Sri Lankan cricket team, suffered injuries in the attack.
Well, I've actually spoken to him a couple of times now. When I first spoke to him, obviously, you know, he was in shock, you know, and obviously said it was a very terrifying experience. But most recently, you know, obviously they've had a few hours now since the incident, and it's all calmed down a little bit, but I think lucky to be alive is a phrase that probably suits at the moment.
How did he describe the attack?
He's not really gone into too much detail other than to say that on arrival to the ground, suddenly they got shot at from all around the bus. And, you know, everybody just dived onto the floor. And, you know, it continued for some time.
I mean, cricket's an extremely popular sport in Pakistan. I mean, it is shocking that cricketers should be targeted in this way.
Yeah, I must admit, I never expected cricket teams to be attacked because it is like a religion in most countries. You know, they are their heroes. And in particular, a Sri Lankan team to get hit, I can't quite come to terms with that. But I suppose we're in the world we are, and anything can happen. And, you know, there's some tough challenges ahead for the game now.
Can you see the Cricket World Cup going ahead as planned in 2011 for Pakistan, Sri Lanka and India?
I think that's obviously, you know, going to be a massive consideration for the ICC. You know, as I say, they've got to weigh up everything that's gone on over the last few days, talk to people involved, and then make the right decisions. But from a personal point of view, I think, you know, they would have to come up with some new plans with regards to that.
And the Indian Premier League scheduled to start next month. Can you see that going ahead as planned?
Again, I think, you know, they've obviously got some tough decisions from, you know, individually, you know, for vast sums of money. You know, people have got to really weigh up the options and say, is it really worth it?
Simon Willis from Kent County Cricket Club. Now, President Barack Obama is developing a new strategy towards Pakistan, recognising that its problems are inextricably linked to those in Afghanistan. Here's Simon Tistel again.
This is equivalent to trying to sort of mould jelly at the moment. It's a very moving target. They've just had some intensive talks with the Pakistanis and the Afghan government in Washington last week, which they're trying to put together a new, broader, regional-based strategy for AFPAC, as the Americans have started calling it, Afghanistan-Pakistan. But every time they think they've got something tied down, the situation changes. In the tribal agencies, for instance, there's been ad hoc patchwork deals being done with various Taliban leaders, some of whom are now say they're adhering to a truce, some of whom are now, according to the Guardian report yesterday, allying themselves for a big offensive against NATO troops in Afghanistan. The whole situation keeps changing, and the bottom line probably for Obama, as for previous American administrations, is going to be that they'll want security ahead of democracy. And if that means sacrificing Zardari, if that means a greater role for the military back in charge of the country, as has been the case for more than half of Pakistan's history, then probably Washington will acquiesce in that.
Are we witnessing the breakup of Pakistan?
Well, that's the great imponderable. And Pakistan is in some ways quite an artificial and very recent creation. It goes back about 62 years to the end of the British Raj. At that time, there was East and West Pakistan. Of course, Bangladesh became independent. The western borders of Pakistan are entirely arbitrary. They're the Durand Line, which was drawn by the British, goes right through the mainly Pashtun areas, and it's quite artificial. And then there's the Punjab, and then there's Baluchistan in the south, which has a strong separatist tendency. So there's no actually inherent reason to think that Pakistan is inevitable and forever. It could well fracture.
Simon Tistel, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/Pakistan. Also on The Guardian's website, Francis Beckett says that lotteries for places are the last resort of a school system in which equality has been deliberately undermined. guardian.co.uk/education to read that. Our legal affairs editor Afua Hirsch discusses whether any legal move against the former Royal Bank of Scotland boss Sir Fred Goodwin's pension would infringe his human rights at guardian.co.uk/business. And Michael Stevenson looks at how Network Rail may be made more accountable at guardian.co.uk/transport. In Washington, Gordon Brown has the rare honour today of addressing a joint session of Congress. The Prime Minister is the first European leader to be invited to Washington for talks with the new President, Barack Obama. The two men met yesterday for 2 hours for talks focused on reviving the economy and reforming international financial regulation. Ewan McCaskill is in Washington.
To address both chambers of Congress, a joint session that's seen as a big honour. So it will be a big, all-encompassing, broad look at the world. I'm sure, well, I was told by British officials that Brown will speak about US-British relations and US-European relations, and there'll be stuff in the economy, but it will be put into that wide sort of historical international context.
Now, yesterday, the two leaders met. At first, we were told there was going to be a press conference, then that was cancelled. Then they did a mini press call. What do you make of that?
Well, there's two tensions. Obama didn't want to do a press conference, and the British officials thought, well, we've brought lots of British journalists over from London, and they're going to be disappointed unless there's time with the two leaders. There's three things. One, Obama spoke about the relationship with Russia, specifically how Russia could help the US and Europe deal with the Iranian nuclear standoff. A big portion of it, they talked about the economy and how the, you know, what they could do to stave off or help the world out of America out of the economic recession as fast as possible.
We dug a very deep hole for ourselves. There were a lot of bad decisions that were made. We are cleaning up that mess.
but it's going to get cleaned up.
I think President Obama's absolutely right. And I think we've had a global banking failure, and it's happened in every part of the world. It's almost like a power cut that went right across the financial system.
And the third thing was this inevitable discussion whenever British and American leaders get together about the special relationship. The special relationship is actually a load of old blah. Americans never talk about it except when a British Prime Minister turns up. But Britain, the British people for some reason, or British political leaders or the British media put great store on the special relationship and keep banging on about it. So Obama did what he had to do and spoke warmly about relations between Britain and America and played down any suggestion that he was going to be less supportive of relations with what he called America's closest ally.
This is my third meeting with Prime Minister Brown, and I'd like to think that our relationship is terrific. And I'm sure he won't dispute me in front of me anyway.
I've enjoyed every conversation that we've had, both by the telephone and when we've met. I don't think I could ever compete with you at basketball. Perhaps tennis.
Tennis, I hear you got a game.
Yeah, we could maybe have a
shot. We haven't tried yet.
He also has a wonderful family, as I do. So we can always talk about our spectacular wives and our wonderful children.
Now, both leaders have stressed the importance of international cooperation in reforming the money markets and reviving the global economy. Do they agree on what measures need to be taken?
No, they don't. Although they're from the same part of the political spectrum, there's a huge gulf. Brown would like to see America and Europe work together and take a sort of global lead in dealing with the economic crisis. The strain in America is protectionist. It's to look to America's interests, and that's reflected in the Democratic Party. And Obama on the campaign trail was pushing protectionist measures. And since he's come into office, there's protectionist measures and his big economic stimulus bill. That sort of multi-billion pound package has measures in it that say roads, bridges, American projects must use American companies, American steel. So it's a Buy America program, and that doesn't go down well with Europeans at all.
Ewan McCaskill. There's full coverage from The Guardian's team in Washington today at guardian.co.uk/America. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, a Brazilian priest honoured at home for his fight against the destruction of the Amazon calls on British consumers to take a stand.
I believe that the European people, when they are eating the McDonald's sandwich, when they are eating chicken here, they are eating Amazonian forest.
But first, Orlando Feige's acclaimed book, The Whisperers, Private Life Under Stalin's Russia, will not be available in Russia after his publisher pulled the plug. The book gathers together first-hand accounts of life under Stalin, and it's been translated into 22 foreign languages, including all the European languages of the former Soviet Union. But Feige says the prospects of it being available in Russian now look remote.
The reason they gave was economic, that in the current credit crunch, they could only publish the best-selling books, but they also expressed, regret over it and the feeling of many of my contacts in Russia and indeed my agent in London is that the real reason behind it is political.
And that's because there's a sort of ongoing debate about the teaching of history and the way history is being interpreted for young Russians.
That's the broader context, yeah. But actually the backstory to this is a raid on Memorial, which is a human rights and historical research center representing millions of victims of repression in the former Soviet Union. And the research for the Whisperers was carried out with Memorial. And we collected hundreds of family archives from private homes, and we carried out thousands of interviews with survivors of the Stalinist regime about their experience of the terror. And the St. Petersburg offices of Memorial were raided by the police on the 4th of December, and the entire archive of Memorial was confiscated on 11 hard disks. This contained like databases with information on victims of oppression, details on burial sites, family archives like the ones I collected with them, transcripts and sound recordings of interviews, photographs and things like this. And among the materials confiscated by the police were all the materials that I had collected with Memorial in St. Petersburg for the Whisperers. That's about a third of all the sources I used in the book.
And do you know what's happened to this material?
Well, as far as we know, it's still in the police department of St. Petersburg. There was an appeal against the raid because the raid was carried out with all sorts of illegal irregularities. And that appeal was upheld by a regional city court on the 20th of January. But then the procuracy of St. Petersburg, who carried out the raid, who ordered the raid, in connection with a criminal investigation of an article in the newspaper supposedly inciting racial hatred, which is just an absurd allegation, the Procuracy of St. Petersburg appealed against that decision. And on the 24th of February, it was upheld by the City Court of St. Petersburg, which declared the raid to be legal, even though it had been carried out with illegal irregularities. But that's how things are done in Russia, I'm afraid. So basically, there's no prospect now of the materials being returned to a memorial, and no guarantee that when they are returned, if they are ever returned, that they won't be returned in a damaged state. So basically, the work of memorial has been paralysed.
And what's the prospect of the Whisperers being published by another company in Russia?
Well, it's possible. The man who sort of set up the deal with Atticus is a well-known journalist in Russia who believed passionately that the book should be in Russian. But I remain sceptical. I'm not expecting now to see The Whisperers published. I think that the climate in Russia at the moment is such that publishers are, especially in an economic situation that is difficult, are inclined to avoid risky publications. As you've said, this is a time when the Kremlin is very actively campaigning for a much more positive view of Soviet history. Textbooks for schools have been censored, which have dwelt on the terror. Pro-Kremlin magazines have come out attacking the work of Memorial and foreign historians who highlight the terror in their belief only to blacken Russia as enemies of Russia. This is a sort of violent language they've used against foreign historians. And so in that sort of climate, you know, publishers, they tend to get a little bit frightened of coming out with a book whose history, you know, is inconvenient to the regime.
Orlando Figes. British consumers are being urged to change what they eat and save the planet. The UK's meat industry relies on soya exported from Brazil. It's one of the main drivers of deforestation in the South American rainforests. Well, that's the message from a Brazilian priest, Father Edilberto Senna. He's been in the UK this week, and he told our environment editor, John Vidal, what presents the greatest threat to the Amazon.
As a native from Amazonia, I can feel in my head and in my heart what is happening there. So I understand that five big threats are menacing Amazonia. First one is the agribusiness. The second one is the mineral companies. Third one is the timber companies. The fourth one are the ranches, the cattle ranches. And the fifth one, strangely, is the federal government, that they are enemies of Amazonia.
Start with the agribusinesses. What is going on here? This is soya, this is...
Exactly. In our region, mainly soya is the commodity. With the problem of the cattle in Europe and with the booming, economic booming of China, suddenly in the beginning of this century, the soya became an important commodity for the Brazilian economy. Because of that, so the new frontier that was opened was our region, Amazonia. The road Santarém-Cuiabá linked the west of the Brazil with the north. And then Santarém became important because there is a good river, deep size, that big ships can go there and fill in with soy and come to Liverpool, to Amsterdam, to France, to China.
And this is the soya which was going into McDonald's and other fast food outlets, I gather, in
Unilever, McDonald's, and other people in Europe that are buying this soy smashed by Cargill here, especially in Amsterdam, and so distribute through the Europe to feed cattle, pigs, chicken, and people.
What is the effect of people of this on the ground? I mean, there's the vast damage to the forest, but are there any other social effects?
Yeah, the social effects are very bad. First, the profits of the soy commodity in our region, Santarin, doesn't stay there. The profits go to Minnesota or go to the south. I believe that the European people, when they are eating the McDonald's sandwich, when they are eating chicken here, they are eating Amazonian forest, because you know, this pig, chicken, and cattle here in Europe, they are fed by the soy that comes from Amazonia.
But you cannot blame the Europeans for the other damage which you have suggested is going to happen, the vast building of hydro dams all the way down the great rivers. This is the Brazilian government which is planning that.
That's a joke, because why Brazilian government is building huge hydroelectrics? It's not for the people. For instance, in the state of Pará, we already have the second biggest hydroelectric in Brazil, that is in Tucuruí. So we have plenty of energy, electricity, to serve the state and also help serving the country. But you know that many cities and municipalities in Pará don't have electricity. Why? Because the government is not interested in the people. They are interested in the big companies. Who are going to use those electricity? The big mineral companies. In order to work with bauxite, you need intensive electricity. So the Brazilian government is submitted to the big companies, Alcoa, Rio Tinto, Vale do Rio Doce, and others, that are exploiting bauxite, iron, copper, and a lot of minerals that Amazon is very rich. You know, when I see how people in the government and how people in Europe look at Amazonia, it's, for me, exactly like in the 16th century, a big colony, rich, El Dorado. They don't know that we are there, 25 million people living in Amazonia. They ignore that.
Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey, and in Washington, Andy Duckworth. With the producers of today's edition of Guardian Daily, I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.